Chapter 41. Later, while the coroner was summoning a jury, Mark Antony and other friends of the late Caesar got hold of the body and lugged it off to the forum, and at last accounts Antony and Brutus were making speeches over it and raising such a row among the people that, as we go to press, the chief of police is satisfied there is going to be a riot and is taking measures accordingly. The widow's protest, one of the saddest things that ever came under my notice, said the banker's clerk, was there in Corning during the war. Dan Murphy enlisted as a private, and fought very bravely. The boys all liked him, and when a wound by and by weakened him down till carrying a musket was too heavy work for him, they clubbed together, and fixed him up as a soodler. He made money then, and sent it always to his wife to bank for him. She was a washer and ironer, and knew enough by hard experience to keep money when she got it. She didn't waste a penny. On the contrary, she began to get miserly as her bank account grew. She grieved to part with a cent, poor creature, for twice in her hard-working life as he had known what it was to be hungry, cold, friendless, sick, and without a dollar in the world, and as he had a haunting dread of suffering so again. Well, at last Dan died, and the boys, in testimony of their esteem and respect for him, telegraphed to Mrs. Murphy to know if she would like to have him embalmed and sent home, when you know the usual custom was to dump a poor devil like him into a shallow hole, and then inform his friends what had become of him. Mrs. Murphy jumped to the conclusion that it would only cost $2 or $3, to embalm her dead husband, and so she telegraphed S. It was at the 8th that the bill for embalming arrived, and was presented to the widow. She uttered a wild sad wail that pierced every heart, and said, $75 for Stoof and Dan, blister their souls. Did them divils suppose I was going to stare de museum, that I'd be dealing in such expensive curiosities? The banker's clerk said there was not a dry eye in the house. The scriptural panoramist, written about 1866. There was a fellow traveling around in that country, said Mr. Nickerson, with a moral religious show, a sort of scriptural panorama, and he hired a wooden-headed old slab to play the piano for him. After the first night's performance, the showman says, "My friend, you seem to know pretty much all the tunes there are, and you worry along first rate. But then, didn't you notice that sometimes last night the piece you happened to be playing was a little rough on the proprieties, so to speak, didn't seem to jibe with the general gait of the picture that was passing at the time, as it were, was a little foreign to the subject, you know, as if you didn't either trump or follow suit, you understand?" The fellow said. He hadn't noticed, but it might be. He had played along just as it came handy. So they put it up, that the simple old dummy was to keep his eye on the panorama after that, and as soon as a stunning picture was reeled out, he was to fit it to a dot with a piece of music that would help the audience to get the idea of the subject, and warm them up like a camp meeting revival. That sort of thing would corral their sympathies, the showman said. There was a big audience that night, mostly middle-aged and old people who belonged to the church and took a strong interest in Bible matters, and the balance were pretty much young bucks and heifers. They always come out strong on panoramas, you know, because it gives them a chance to taste one another's complexions in the dark. Well, the showman began to swell himself up for his lecture, and the old mud jobber tackled the piano and ran his fingers up and down once or twice to see that she was all right, and the fellows behind the curtain commenced to grind out the panorama. The showman balanced his weight on his right foot and propped his hands over his hips and flung his eyes over his shoulder at the scenery and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the painting now before you illustrates the beautiful and touching parable of the prodigal son. Observe the happy expression just breaking over the features of the poor, suffering youth so worn and weary with his long march. Note also the ecstasy beaming from the uplifted countenance of the aged father, and the joy that sparkles in the eyes of the excited group of youths and maidens, and seems ready to burst into the welcoming chorus from their lips. The lesson, my friends, is as solemn and instructive as the story is tender and beautiful. The mud jobber was all ready, and when the second speech was finished, struck up. We'll all get blind drunk when Johnny comes marching home. Some of the people giggled, and some groaned a little. The showman couldn't say a word. He looked at the pianist sharp, but he was all lovely and serene. He didn't know there was anything out of gear. The panorama moved on, and the showman drummed up his grit and started afresh. Ladies and gentlemen, the fine picture now unfolding itself to your gaze exhibits one of the most notable events in Bible history, our Savior and his disciples upon the Sea of Galilee. How grand, how awe-inspiring are the reflections which the subject invokes. What sublimity of faith is revealed to us in this lesson from the sacred writings. The Savior rebukes the angry waves, and walks securely upon the bosom of the deep. All around the house they were whispering, "Oh, how lovely, how beautiful." And the orchestra let himself out again. Life on the ocean wave, and a home on the rolling deep. There was a good deal of honest snickering turned on this time, and considerable groaning, and one or two old deacons got up and went out. The showman grated his teeth, and cursed the piano man to himself. But the fellow sat there like a knot on a log, and seemed to think he was doing first rate. After things got quiet, the showman thought he would make one more stagger at it, anyway, though his confidence was beginning to get mighty shaky. The suits started the panorama grinding along again, and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, this exquisite painting represents the raising of Lazarus from the dead by our Savior. The subject has been handled with marvelous skill by the artist, and such touching sweetness and tenderness of expression has he thrown into it, that I have known peculiarly sensitive persons to be even affected to tears by looking at it. Observe the half-confused, half-inquiring look upon the countenance of the awakened Lazarus. Observe, also, the attitude and expression of the Savior, who takes him gently by the sleeve of his shroud with one hand, while he points with the other toward the distant city." Before anybody could get off an opinion in the case, the innocent old ass at the piano struck up, "Ohm, rise up, William Rye Lee, and go along with me. Wee you." All the solemn old flats got up in a huff to go, and everybody else laughed till the windows rattled. The showman went down, and grabbed the orchestra, and shook him up and says, "That lets you out, you know, you chowder-headed old clam. Go to the doorkeeper, and get your money, and cut your stick, Vamos the ranch. Ladies and gentlemen, circumstances over which I have no control compel me prematurely to dismiss the house." Curing a cold, written about 1864, it is a good thing, perhaps, to write for the amusement of the public, but it is a far higher and nobler thing, to write for their instruction, their profit, their actual and tangible benefit. The latter is the sole object of this article. If it prove the means of restoring to health one solitary sufferer among my race, of lighting up once more the fire of hope and joy in his faded eyes, or bringing back to his dead heart again the quick, generous impulses of other days, I shall be amply rewarded for my labor. My soul will be permeated with the sacred delight a Christian feels when he has done a good, unselfish deed. Having led a pure and blameless life, I am justified in believing that no man who knows me will reject the suggestions I am about to make, out of fear that I am trying to deceive him. Let the public do itself the honor to read my experience in doctoring a cold, as herein set forth, and then follow in my footsteps. When the White House was burned in Virginia City, I lost my home, my happiness, my constitution, and my trunk. The loss of the two first-named articles was a matter of no great consequence, since a home without a mother, or a sister, or a distant young female relative in it, to remind you, by putting your soiled linen out of sight, and taking your boots down off the mantelpiece, that there are those who think about you and care for you, is easily obtained. And I cared nothing for the loss of my happiness, because, not being a poet, it could not be possible that melancholy would abide with me long. But to lose a good constitution, and a better trunk were serious misfortunes. On the day of the fire my constitution succumbed to a severe cold, caused by undue exertion in getting ready to do something. I suffered to no purpose to, because the plan I was figuring it for the extinguishing of the fire was so elaborate that I never got it completed until the middle of the following week. The first time I began to sneeze, a friend told me to go and bathe my feet in hot water and go to bed. I did so. Shortly afterward, another friend advised me to get up and take a cold shower bath. I did that also. Within the hour, another friend assured me that it was policy to feed a cold and starve a fever. I had both. So I thought it best to fill myself up for the cold, and then keep dark, and let the fever starve a while. In a case of this kind, I seldom do things by halves. I ate pretty heartily. I conferred my custom upon a stranger who had just opened his restaurant that morning. He waited near me in respectful silence until I had finished feeding my cold, when he inquired if the people about Virginia City were much afflicted with colds. I told him I thought they were. He then went out and took in his sign. I started down toward the office, and on the way encountered another bosom friend, who told me that a quart of salt water, taken warm, would come as near curing a cold as anything in the world. I hardly thought I had room for it, but I tried it anyhow. The result was surprising. I believed I had thrown up my immortal soul. Now, as I am giving my experience only for the benefit of those who are troubled with the distemper I am writing about, I feel that they will see the propriety of my cautioning them against following such portions of it as proved inefficient with me, and acting upon this conviction, I warn them against warm salt water. It may be a good enough remedy, but I think it is too severe. If I had another cold in the head, and there were no course left me but to take either an earthquake or a quart of warm salt water, I would take my chances on the earthquake. After the storm which had been raging in my stomach had subsided, and no more Good Samaritans happening along, I went on borrowing handkerchiefs again, and blowing them to atoms, as had been my custom in the early stages of my cold, until I came across a lady who had just arrived from over the plains, and who said as he had lived in a part of the country where doctors were scarce, and had from necessity acquired considerable skill in the treatment of simple amyly complaints. I knew she must have had much experience, for she appeared to be 150 years old. She mixed a decoction composed of molasses, aquafortis, turpentine, and various other drugs, and instructed me to take a wine glass full of it every 15 minutes. I never took but one dose. That was enough. It robbed me of all moral principle, and awoke every unworthy impulse of my nature. Under its malign influence my brain conceived miracles of meanness, but my hands were too feeble to execute them. At that time, had it not been that my strength had surrendered to a succession of assaults from infallible remedies for my cold, I am satisfied that I would have tried to rob the graveyard. Like most other people, I often feel mean, and act accordingly. But until I took that medicine I had never reveled in such supernatural depravity, and felt proud of it. At the end of 2 days I was ready to go to doctoring again. I took a few more unfailing remedies, and finally drove my cold from my head to my lungs. I got to coughing incessantly, and my voice fell below zero. I conversed in a thundering bass, 2 octaves below my natural tone, I could only compass my regular nightly repose by coughing myself down to a state of utter exhaustion, and then the moment I began to talk in my sleep, my discordant voice woke me up again. My case grew more and more serious every day. A plain gin was recommended. I took it. Then gin and molasses. I took that also. Then gin and onions. I added the onions, and took all three. I detected no particular result, however, except that I had acquired a breath like a buzzard's. I found I had to travel for my health. I went to Lake Bigler with my reportorial comrade, Wilson. It is gratifying to me to reflect that we traveled in considerable style. We went in the Pioneer coach, and my friend took all his baggage with him, consisting of two excellent silk handkerchiefs, and a daguerreotype of his grandmother. We sailed and hunted and fished, and danced all day, and I doctored my cough all night. By managing in this way, I made out to improve every hour in the 20-4. But my disease continued to grow worse. A sheet bath was recommended. I had never refused a remedy yet, and it seemed poor policy to commence then. Therefore I determined to take a sheet bath, notwithstanding I had no idea what sort of arrangement it was. It was administered at midnight, and the weather was very frosty. My breast and back were bared, and a sheet there appeared to be 1,000 yards of it, soaked in ice water, was wound around me until I resembled a swab for a Columbiad. It is a cruel expedient. When the chilly rag touches one's warm flesh, it makes him start with sudden violence, and gasp for breath just as men do in the death agony. It froze the marrow in my bones, and stopped the beating of my heart. I thought my time had come. Young Wilson said the circumstance reminded him of an anecdote about a Negro who was being baptized, and who slipped from the parson's grasp, and came near being drowned. He floundered around, though, and finally rose up out of the water considerably strangled and furiously angry, and started ashore at once, spouting water like a whale, and remarking, with great asperity, that neo these days some gentleman's nigger gwine to get killed with jis is such damn foolishness as this. Never take a sheet bath, never. Next to meeting a lady acquaintance who, for reasons best known to herself, don't see you when she looks at you, and don't know you when she does see you, it is the most uncomfortable thing in the world. But, as I was saying, when the sheet bath failed to cure my cough. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.